Welcome to the We Are Libertarians Daily Podcast. I am your host, Hody Johns. I am here with Paul. How are you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing great, Hody.
You're doing better than great because you and I just got promotions.
Yeah.
We are no longer guest hosts. We're no longer co-hosts. Paul and I are now full-fledged hosts on the We Are Libertarians Network. We got permission to call ourselves that, and yeah. I'm just going to run with that all day.
You know, I'm making 1,000 times more than I was as a lackey.
Oh, man, I don't think we're supposed to talk wages, but, I mean, I think I got 2,000 times more than I did before.
Hey, you know what? That's fine. 1 or 2,000 times nothing is still nothing.
Oh, no, you blew the secret. Well, hopefully
I don't think it was much of a secret, considering Chris's monetary woes.
Hopefully, our future employers only listen to the 1,000 to 2,000 times what we're making before and not that last part. They just tuned out after like 30 seconds. Well, we're going to dive into this here. We are already planning on calling this part one. So everybody knows. Because it is too big a problem. Paul and I, again, are answering your tough questions, which we love to do. This one is healthcare fixable? And it's just too big to do in one episode. I mean, Paul, you even said right off the bat, you're like, I'd love to dive into it, but there's no way in 30 minutes that we're going to fix all of healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, we can fix everything as libertarians, guaranteed 100%, but not in 30 minutes. That's a little excessive even.
Oh, man, as much as we like to feel like superheroes, we'll need a full movie as opposed to just a TV show is what you're saying. Okay. All right. Well, let's get into this. So we plan on this first part to be talking about how we would fix it if we fix it within the system. So we're going to look at the system. There's going to be a lot of numbers here. I have so many sources here. I'm probably looking at like 15 different sources. So please check our show notes because I'm not going to quote all of the sources, but just know, yes, there are sources for all of these. So we got a tale of two numbers. If we go to the U.S. debt clock, and a lot of people look at, say, oh, healthcare, we're going into debt over healthcare, and they look at we're spending over $1 trillion a year on healthcare, but that's only the tip of the iceberg, and there's something at the bottom there called unfunded liability for Medicare and Medicaid, and that one's almost $28 trillion. So you say, what is that $28 trillion? Well, what that $28 trillion is money that we have promised to people that we owe that we have not paid back yet. So we're already $28 trillion in debt. We have to pay our doctors and our hospitals $28 trillion. That's more than the entire national debt. Bigger than the whole thing.
That's our national debt and then another 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Well, and you say in another 3 or 4 years, and that's why we got to get a wraps on it now. Because if you jump ahead just 2 years to 2020, we're still taking a loss. We're still growing. That $28 trillion is still growing, right, in medical debt. We will have to pay, this year we're going to pay $1 trillion. 2 years we're going to have to pay $1.2 trillion. After that, we got to pay $1.4 trillion, you know, and it just keeps going on and on. And this is still to keep going slightly into debt. Right. So we got to break even here somehow.
So it starts by shaving some of the costs from the big budget items of the current system. And you've done a wonderful job breaking it all down in the notes here. What is your number one savings here?
Well, okay. So the way I get to this number one savings here. First of all, we got to talk about inflation being 2.3%. And then we got to talk about, okay, if we're paying $1 trillion a year and we owe $28 trillion, that means we're paying like 4%, less than 4% back to doctors every year. Meaning if you do a heart transplant, I will pay you back 4% of what that heart transplant costs every year until I have it paid off. Combined with the inflation rate, that means we won't be paying these things off for 50 years. Meaning, if you're a doctor or hospital, any procedure you do, that goes under Medicare or Medicaid, some type of government program, will get paid off in 50 years if we're being charitable.
Right.
So, huge problem. This is according to Investopedia. I just took the top six expenses in healthcare. Why is our healthcare so expensive? And so we're going to do in this episode is go line by line and say, okay, as libertarians, how do we fix this? Here's our break-even goal. We need to pay $1.2 trillion on it this year in order for that number, for that debt to go down, right? So we say, okay, I need to break $1.2 trillion. If I pay $1.2 trillion on it, it goes down. Now, I guess one more thing before I get into the top one. I know I'm taking a long time answering your question here. But before I get to that first one, when somebody says we need to be pay less than that $1 trillion on healthcare, unfortunately, we're in so much debt that we can't do that anymore. We actually, this is, and I support reducing the size of government, right? We need to pay less on pretty much everything. But you may recall, even when Rand Paul supported the balanced budget amendment, it was actually him, if you can believe this, in talks with Bernie Sanders, where they amended it so that the healthcare payments stayed the same. And the reason being we can downsize everything else but can't downsize this is because it's like if you pay less than you owe on your credit card. It's just going to grow further down the line. So unfortunately, $1.2 trillion we have to pay if we're ever going to balance the budget or if we're going to pay off the debt, we have to pay more than the $1.2 trillion every single year. Okay. Number one, administrative costs. The number one reason our healthcare costs are so high is the administration costs running our healthcare system are astronomical. About one quarter of healthcare cost is associated with administration, which is far higher than in any other country. One example was the 1,300 billing clerks at Duke University, which only has 900 beds. Those billing specialists are needed to determine how to bill to meet the varying requirements of multiple insurers. Canada and other countries with a single-payer system don't require this level of staffing to administer healthcare. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is one of those things that people don't like to focus on when they're talking about the healthcare costs that we're incurring in America now. Yes, a single-payer system would eliminate these as bureaucrats within the healthcare system, but they would be found jobs elsewhere. And also, this is the fastest growing cost, the cost of compliance with government regulations and with insurance company regulations.
Yes, because, and the issue, and Paul hit it on the head, we mandate the number of people not based on needing them. We mandate the date them because we say, well, we need these jobs. Do you really want to lay these people off? Do you really want to fire these people? Well, unfortunately, paying this many people is bankrupting our system. And if you have 1,300 people to try to get you to pay or organize your payment and only 900 people to pay, that's a problem. And a lot of these rules and these mandates were established before the internet era. And so what happened was, is we didn't decrease that number of people when we say, oh, we can just bill them online. That only takes a couple of people. So these administration costs haven't gone down. According to Beckers, if we just get with the times, we go from spending 31% of our payments on the healthcare to 15.5%, which is exactly half, which saves us $186 billion a year. It's not a small number.
No, and that right there is basically one-sixth of the goal in and of itself.
Yes, right. So we got a good chunk. We're right on pace. We say, okay, we're trying to pay $1.2 trillion a year. There's a sixth of it. Yay. Drug costs is number two. I don't think anybody's surprised by this one, but you might be surprised by the scope of it. The FDA exemplifies self-empowerment influence, continually regulating the pharmaceutical industry I can say this, continually regulating the pharmaceutical industry so tightly that it has killed new or biosimilar medications before they reach the marketplace, solidifying monopolies on medications. This crony capitalistic practice secures more market share and influence for major industry players, preventing healthy competition in a free market. I think libertarians have covered this a lot of times, haven't we, Paul?
Yeah, this is one of the areas where I think we actually do good work in combating the status quo, is challenging the status quo and wanting to open up the marketplace. You know, drug monopolies just do not, they're not true monopolies. The chemicals oftentimes are actually somewhat relatively easy to make. Mm-hmm. It's just the research that goes into them has to be paid back. So we've, at governmental policy level, have decided to give lifetime or term monopolies. And it just does not benefit the consumer.
It's closer to contract work than really like a free market. I think anybody who's got diabetes and looks at the price of insulin, if you're in, say, the UK, where they're allowed to have competing prices and negotiating prices, you've got a selection of types of insulin, as well as the cost. The cost is about the price of a stick of deodorant, first of all. Also, the amount of choices you have is about equivalent with sticks of deodorant as well. Like, it's like you are, like, so think about that when you look at how many sticks, types of deodorant you have, how easy they are to access, how cheap they are. That's the same as insulin over there. Over here, definitely not that way. Only three drug companies are allowed to make 90% of the drugs. And here's the issue. They don't have competing brands in most cases. And even in cases where they do, for example, like opioids, they're on different levels. So, for example, if a doctor prescribes you, you know, a 12.5, say, milligram per hour dispersal of an opioid, well, there's only one company that makes the 12.5. And maybe another company will make the 3, but they don't compete with each other. And unfortunately, right, by rule, FDA rule, they're not allowed to until the FDA approves it.
Yeah, the inability to compete, like, and no doctor in their practice is going to be able to prescribe you 4 pills of the 3 milligram per hour dispersal.
Yep,
because they're going to be perceived as over prescribing. So there aren't ways to work around it when you need highly specific medications. Painkillers are easier, but...
Yeah, and what that does is that's made us 3 times as much as it should be, according to Scientific American. So if we cut that off... Now, here's the thing. This is a tale of two numbers again. This will save us $136 billion a year towards Medicare and Medicaid, but remember that the market is way bigger than just what we're going into debt for. So while we're specifically analyzing the problem with the debt in this episode, because that's what's going to sink us, let's not forget all the people that do pay for it out of pocket, that don't pay Medicaid, Medicare. Those guys are also saving... I mean, we're talking paying a third of the amount that they were before on average. And for some cases, like an epinephrine pen or insulin, I mean, you're looking at 1 or 2% of what they're paying now.
Yeah.
Defensive medicine, Paul, you've got an interesting story about this one. So I was surprised to see this at number 3. You weren't. Let me tell you what it is. Let me have Paul break it down for you, though. Doctors are afraid they'll get sued, so they order multiple tests, even when they're certain what the diagnosis is already. A Gallup survey estimates, get this, $650 billion annually is attributed to defensive medicine. Everyone pays the bill on this with higher insurance premiums, co-pays, out-of-pocket costs, across the board, and the taxes go to pay for government healthcare programs. So, I mean, my solution is you need to give people to opt out, but give us your story. Tell us why that's so important.
Yeah, so about four or so years ago now, I went to a clinic here in Indianapolis with a rather routine illness. I knew because of the symptoms it was either strep throat or tonsillitis. White patches in the back of my throat are pretty much a dead giveaway, and I've had it before. So I go in knowing what the diagnosis is and what I need. I need a $10 round of amoxicillin.
You already know. Okay.
Yeah, I could write the prescription myself, but I'm not allowed to prescribe my own medications because maybe we'll get into that. but I go in and instead of just looking at my throat and, yeah, you've got strep throat or tonsillitis, one of the two, the treatment's the same. I had to undergo a swab test for oral herpes, which I was actually rather insulted by, and that's why it stuck with me.
Well, is it an insult or is it a compliment, really? I mean, I'm in a virgin with, you know, oral herpes. That's hard to get, right?
Yeah.
I'm having fun at your expense. I'm sorry.
No. I love it. Thank you. So, not only did I undergo an unnecessary test here, I didn't get a bill for that clinic visit in the mail for a year. It was a solid year later. And when I got it, the cost for the entire visit was $250. For something that I could have diagnosed myself and gotten $20 worth of medication for.
And you already knew what you needed. So you could have gone to the supermarket, picked it up, left, if that were legal, I guess.
Yeah, no, and I understand the dangers of allowing people to unfettered access to powerful antibiotics because of the risks of super bugs, but still, it should not have been the ordeal I went through to wait for basically 3 hours and inflate my costs to well over 10 times what it should have been.
Wow.
Oh, and the kicker is, I got a call 2 days later saying that they had failed that test. They didn't even make the test correctly.
Oh, so no conclusion. So yeah. Maybe you do have oral herpes. I mean,
well, it cleared up with antibiotics, so I'm going to guess it wasn't a viral infection.
Probably not. And like you said, you know yourself, like, I mean, better than a drug company, and probably even better than your doctor, but they did it anyway. There's incentive to do it anyway. Because they get money for doing it.
I was floored when that was proposed, and it's like, no, that's not necessary. Well, we're going to do it anyway.
Oh my gosh. So to put a number, a financial number on getting rid of stories like yours. Again, this is according to Gallup, and I can barely believe it. Giving people a choice to opt out of suing. Say you actually did have oral herpes, but you declined the test, right? Didn't want it, you know, and you're going to pay the price for it. But you also agree to not sue your doctor because he wanted to take the test. This makes healthcare 3 times cheaper. Okay? Now, it's hard to quantify this number because this is based on how many people opt out and how many people opt in. Say I want to be able to sue my doctor for missing something, and I'm willing to pay 3 times more for a doctor that's willing to take that risk, then I'll pay 3 times more. But let's say just charitably half. Let's say half of people say, no, I like you. I know what it is. My finger's infected because of a splinter. You know, I see the splinter. I just need some help, you know. Or even something simple like, I have a heart condition. I know what the heart condition is. This is what I need. Then this saves us, if half of the people agree to not to make it three times cheaper, then it saves us $325 billion towards the debt, not counting all the other people that save money by paying it out of pocket. $325 billion, towards the debt. And so while your story is silly, remember that we need to amplify your story times I mean, do you think your story is unique? Or do you think there's a million people that relate to it?
No, and I mean, my story is one of a small test, like a very uninvasive thing. But, you know, you start looking at things like, you know, well, that is probably just a cyst. It looks exactly like a cyst, but let's go in for a biopsy anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're looking at a few grand for a exploratory test that's going to yield nothing.
Right. So it's not only relatable, it's very believable, and I think other people have had that experience. We all get back our bill from a hospital when we've had to go in and say, I broke my arm. Now, what is this payment for $1,000 here? What is this $800? What is this $500 here? You know, whatever it may be. It's like, well, we had to look for infections and we did like three tests for that. And so that leads directly into 4 and 5 most expensive parts of healthcare. And I've combined these. It's wages and work rules, as well as an expensive mix of treatments. U.S. medical practitioners also tend to use a more expensive mix of treatments. When compared to other developed countries, for example, the U.S. does 3 times as many mammograms, 2.5 times the number of MRIs, and does 31% more cesarean sections. This results in more being spent on technology in more locations. Another key part of the mix is more people in the U.S. are treated by specialists, whose fees are higher than primary care doctors, when the same types of treatments are done at primary care level in the other countries. Specialists command higher pay, which drives up the cost for everyone. Now, I'm not opposed to a specialist, but if you have a foot doctor getting recommended to you every time you stub a toe, suddenly it's like, well, why? My regular doctor in his 8 years of medical school can probably deal with my stub toe.
Yeah. So another little anecdote. A good friend of mine slipped on a carpeted set of stairs and ended up breaking his pinky toe. What proceeded to befall him would be comical if it wasn't so infuriating, because they had a parade of no less than 4 doctors come in at various points, check out his x-rays, and it was almost like they were doing a sketch to see how far they could push him. One would come in and say, oh yeah, your toe is broken, you know, looking at it sticking out at a right angle from the others.
Okay.
And the next one would come in and be like, I don't know, I don't think your toe is broken. And they proceeded to go back and forth until one doctor finally said, those other guys are idiots. Your toe is broken. Here's what we're going to do for you.
Wow.
They wasted the time of at least 3, possibly 4 highly trained physicians to tell him what was plainly evident.
So there's an incentive to do this wrapped up in this 4 and 5, and this is why I combine them. Is it's not like they do this because they're idiots. It's not like our doctors here are more idiotic. Paul, if you do treatments and you only get 4% per year on every treatment you do, and you've racked up a ridiculous amount of debt from college, how are you going to make money? You need to do a lot of 4% treatments, don't you?
Yeah.
So suddenly, instead of saying, well, if I do this one thing, it'll be all cleared up, the cost of it is $200, and I'll get, you know, I should have chosen an even number, $8, there you go, back a year until the $200 is paid off. That's no good. That's no good for me. I need the $200 to stay afloat. So I'm going to maximize as many people as I can and do as expensive a test as I can. And that way that 4% that I get back every year starts to stack up, right? And so it's not good for the consumer and it's not good for the doctors. So I'm not blaming the doctors here, but this is their system. You know, even a competitive market would have to do the exact same thing if they had the amount of revenue that they could make limited like this. So again, let's put a number to it. If we aren't incentivized to run more tests, the cost against the debt, specifically $210 billion. The last point is branding. Prices are made are made up depending on who the payer is. Doctors and hospitals work with drug companies to only recommend a certain brand of drug. This is not the free market because you, so even if there are two drugs, right, this isn't a free market because you, the consumer, you're not the one shopping and comparing. So you're not saying what's most affordable to me. It's the doctors in the hospital, and odds are they're not thinking of what's least expensive. In fact, they're incentivized to look at what's the most expensive option, right?
Yeah, no. And oftentimes, I mean, this is something that has just been corrected from a legal standpoint is, you know, they were able to fly doctors out to private islands and party with them for a week and then send them back with a note attached to them saying, oh yeah, by the way, Bayer Pharma would like your business.
Yeah, and who's footing the cost of those flights?
Well, ultimately it comes down to the consumer.
And the consumer is somebody in chronic pain, right?
Yeah, chronic pain or in dire need with few alternatives and, you know, no time to consider all the options. They don't have to twist your arm. It's already in a cast.
Exactly. You are already busted up. I guess they don't have to worry about you because they're not worried that you'll go to a somewhere else. Your arm's broken. It needs to get fixed, and you have to rely on them to fix it. You know, this isn't like food where you get your choice of where you go out to eat, even though you didn't have to eat. You know?
Nobody plans for, well, very few people plan for medical emergencies, but I can tell you where I'm going to eat today. You know?
Right.
We plan certain costs out ahead of time, but you just cannot prepare for a broken arm in a car accident or something like that. And you just get blindsided by these things.
Sure. And we're not going to talk about insurance on this episode, but that's what it's there for. And it's, I feel for them because they can't see it either. And if you look at their margin of cost, they're usually very low in spite of what, you know, lavish lives you sometimes see their CEO. You got to remember that there's a lot of times that's skin of their teeth money that you're seeing them spend. There's a lot of reform to be doing with insurance, and so I'm not letting them off the hook completely. They've had plenty to do with the cronyism and the buying off of politicians and the making of rules. But when the whole situation, like you're saying, is no one can know it's coming. Whether you're insurance or a person, it's just going to happen. And so we need to have a system in place that says when it happens, here's how we take care of it, as opposed to, ha, 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 look what happened to you. That's a shame. You're going to lose a bunch of money. On branding specifically, $86 billion a year. So that's our lowest one. But, you know, according to Investopedia, that was the lowest one. As far as costs currently towards the debt. Now, remember, this $86 billion, that's just towards the debt. It's a lot more. So let's combine everything we've talked about so far. Let's do some math. We've got our top 1 through 6. If we just address those 1 through 6 most expensive things about the U.S. healthcare system, we save $943 billion. Okay, so we needed to hit $1.2 trillion to start paying down the debt. Well, we're paying $1 trillion right now. So if I can save us $943 billion a year, combine that with the $1 trillion we pay this year, we pay down the debt in 36 years. That's the whole $28 trillion number. That leaves our grandchildren unencumbered by the debt. It's a huge number. It looks like a climb, but when somebody tells you, at this moment in history, if somebody tells you that the debt is unmanageable, if it was unmanageable, you'd know because our economy would collapse, countries would, you know, would sell out, and there'd be no way. They know that we are able to fix this if we make painful decisions. At this moment in time, it is less painful to make this decision now than it will be in 4 years. And then in 4 years after that, it'll be more painful and more painful and more painful. So we need to push for this now.
Yeah. It's the same thing with paying down any other debt. The interest alone is always compounding, but, you know, unfortunately with healthcare costs, we're in the position that we keep adding more principal.
Yep. Interest, not coincidentally, that's our fifth highest expenditure in the U.S.
Oh, like,
So when you're looking at all this, just remember, I mean, that's even more than federal pensions is interest on the debt. So I'm going to leave you with my final thought, and I'll give you a little bit of time. My final thought is this. I've given you a pretty drastic solution. Now, introducing any, like even half of these, goes a long way. I proposed a solution which we pay it off in 36 years, working within the system that we have now, really just emulating what other countries are already doing and allowing the free market to take its course, right? Not incentivizing more expensive treatment, making people compete, you know, giving the consumers more choices. That saves us $943 billion a year towards the debt. Probably in all Americans, it saves probably $3 trillion. So here's the problem. When you get a healthcare for all back bill, and they tell you how awesome it is because it'll reduce costs by $100 billion over the next 10 years, you need to politely tell those people to shut the heck up. Because healthcare costs are going to increase by $200 billion next year. So somebody that proposes this radical single-payer healthcare for all something that gives, hey, it's going to reduce spending by over $100 billion in the next 10 years, that literally won't even work for 1 year. Even if you're accurate, even if we consolidate it to $100 billion in 1 year, it's not enough. So the reason the numbers are important, and I know math's a little boring to listen to, it is for me too, so I understand. But the math is important because when somebody tells you this, you say in your head, $100 billion sounds like a lot. But with what it takes with the debt we have ourselves in, it isn't. So don't listen to somebody unless they're talking about real, substantial monetary change to the healthcare system. All right, Paul, time is yours, baby.
Yeah, no, the biggest thing that we can do is to start tackling some of these big ticket items here. I plan on, in our part two that I'm planning, going over and we're going to see what, from the ground up, let's discard the current system, let's assume we pay everything off and, you know, like you pay off a bad car that's just a money dump, you decide to switch to something new. We're going to look at what something new actually would look like. And it's going to be pretty radically different, in my opinion, from what we've seen in the last century with a health insurance as the main payer system.
I look forward to it. This whole episode we worked within the current system, but this current system was not based on common sense. So no. If we wanted to fix this further and reimagine it, recreate, tell you what it looks like in a libertarian society, hang tight for part two. We will get you that probably sometime next week. We just look forward to talking to you guys again. Paul, anything else you got for him?
No. Well, you know, with the recent signals that we're going to see a purge of libertarian media from social media, please do come join us on our Discord. Link is on the website. It's a quiet place, but it's a good place to have a discussion, and you can't get zucked on Discord.
Discord is awesome. Just so you know, that's how you guys can actually submit the show ideas. If you want to see Paul and I tackle one of your tough questions, that's actually where all of our tough questions have come from so far. So,
yep.
Thank you so much for joining us. Paul, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, great talking to you too, Hody. See you next time.